supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, bringing you true personal stories about the pressing issues of our time. I'm Jamie J., your host and executive director of First Person Arts. I'm here in the studio with
Elizabeth Perez Luna of WHYY.
We definitely live in a time of escalated political tension. Protests are fraught with danger. Remember, just a few weeks ago in Charlottesville, Virginia, a 32-year-old woman was killed and at least 19 were injured when a far-right white nationalist drove his car into a crowd of anti-racism protesters there. And just a few months before that, two men were stabbed to death on a Portland, Oregon subway. Their crime? They intervened to stop a man in an anti-Muslim rant against two women, one of whom was wearing a hijab. If that doesn't make you think twice about intervening, I don't know what would. But what about that saying, evil prospers when good men do nothing? So in an effort to explore how to intervene in such situations safely, we reached out to Kathy Berry Green of BG Productions here in Philadelphia. Kathy has a long history of participating in and training people in nonviolent direct action and blockade techniques. She's worked with a who's who of activist groups, including Earth First, Food Not Bombs, the Ruckus Society, and Occupy Philly, to name just a few. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, Kathy, it seems to me, reading your bio and reading about you, that you spent a lot of time in disruptive environments.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that would be an understatement. Yeah, I have a long history of doing nonviolent civil disobedience, focusing predominantly on environmental and social justice issues. I've been doing it for over 30 years, and I don't foresee stopping anytime soon.
I'm curious, how do you define protest?
To me, protesting is anybody who's willing to take a stand, using a myriad of tactics to do that, take a stand against something that they don't agree with, or take a stand for something they would like to see happen.
So throughout the years, protests have been used, boycotts have been used, marches, sit-ins, walk-ins, silent protests, noisy protests. How has that evolved, and how is it still effective in any of these definitions?
Oh, I think it's totally effective. I think that looking at what happened with the proposed health care bill from the Senate is a prime example of protests in different forms stopping the vote. To me, protesting is not only taking to the streets, but also taking your voice into your own community, whether it be your church or your work or your school, letter writing, fax writing, protesting in the street, going to Washington and protesting in front of, say, Senator Toomey's office, or the encampment that happened overnight that I attended here in Philadelphia in front of Toomey's office. All of those things, I fully, with all of my heart, believe make a difference. Right now, it's a little hard because some of the things that over the years I thought we fought and won, now we have to do it again. But I think that's just as the cycle. And hopefully, ultimately, that cycle will just phase itself out and we'll keep pushing for even new things and not just trying to go back to the things that we had already had.
Kathy, can you tell me your first act of protest? Tell me the story.
So to me, my first act of protest was I was 16 years old and I lived in a very conservative, preppy little town called Granville in Ohio. It's the headquarters of Dow Chemical and Owens Corning Fiberglass, Denison University, which is a very liberal arts school. So it's 60 miles outside of Columbus. And I was a lot different than most of the people that went there, the preppy, go with the flow kind of people. And I used to get 17 magazine, and there was an article in 17 magazine, and it described young ladies and school age girls. And the point of the article was that everyone really was supposed to be perfect Katie. I'll never forget it. And I did not fit perfect Katie. I fit messy Millie, and I still do. And messy Millie had a backpack full of stuff, and her locker was a mess. And she was always in a rush or working on 10 things at once and was outspoken. At least this is how I, years later, still interpret messy Millie. And everyone was supposed to be perfect Katie. And I wrote 17 magazine, and I said, I am happy to be messy Millie, and I don't ever want to be perfect Katie. And I don't want your magazine anymore. And I canceled my subscription. And I really realized at that moment that that was the path I was on. As a senior, I worked on the journalism team for the newspaper. And they do these things called, they used to, senior wills, where you will stuff to underclassmen. And I was often picked on and teased, and people would say things like, nuke the whales to me. And because that was really all they knew, was I was against nuclear weapons and I was for saving whales, which I never understood as a bad thing. And so the senior paper came out, and there were all kinds of pretty derogatory, kind of bullying things left to me. And even though you were supposed to be a senior, leaving them to underclassmen. And my teacher had asked me if I wanted us to pull them, and I said, heck no, you know, that's fine by me, a little. Opposition never hurt me. And so I will back the ability to be different to anybody who thought they could handle it.
Did you ever see or confront any one person that left you something derogatory in that paper?
No, I don't waste my energy on them. I hadn't gone back to my high school or to the reunions until I went to my 25th reunion. And it's amazing how many people wish they had been more like me and stood up for things.
How so?
There's a lot of folks that now, thanks to Facebook, you know, I'm in touch with more. And at the reunion, I had gone with my husband, and my husband's African-American. And I grew up in an all-white school, but that wasn't my only school I had ever lived in. So I had exposure to many different types of people. And so we were at the reunion, and, you know, people just kind of got their eyes open. And a couple of the women that I had talked to afterwards had said that, you know, they wished that growing up that they hadn't felt the need to fit in and to follow what everybody else was doing and to kind of forge their own path. And now that the election has happened, and I see a lot of folks that I went to high school with on Facebook, some I've stopped and unfollowed based on their political views. But many I'm seeing how much they're taking a stand now. And a lot of different folks private message me, ask for advice or opinions, or just someone to share how they're feeling with.
You've been to a lot of protests.
Yes.
And I understand that there are different tactics.
Yes.
I'm curious to know what protest in your memory was the most effective. And why?
I find so many that I've been to, from small-scale tree sits and stopping logging operations. But I think the moment for me that really was a catalyst and kind of changed things was the WTO protests in 1999. I helped organize the blockades that happened to shut down Seattle when the WTO came to town.
Tell us what the WTO is.
Oh, the World Trade Organization. Had their large meeting in Seattle, and for half a year or more, different groups organized. And I worked with a group that's called the Ruckus Society, and I worked with Rainforest Action Network, and I helped train folks to do various blockade techniques. And the morning that the delegates tried to get through to the meeting, all these intersections throughout the city of Seattle were shut down with people, bodies, linking arms, using various forms of lockdown materials, which could range from PVC pipes to bike locks around their neck to just linking their arms together. And while the city of Seattle responded with some intense violence towards everybody, I watched hundreds of people holding those spots while tear gas and rubber bullets just rained down on them. And the meetings for the WTO were canceled. People couldn't get in. And I'll never forget that. There is nothing stronger to me than the power of people taking a stand.
What were they protesting against?
Oh, the horribleness of globalization. The uniqueness about the WTO, and one of the reasons to me it was such a turning point, was so many different types of groups came together, be it the unions, the longshoremen who shut down the shore, environmentalists for, you know, better environmental regulations worldwide, people for human rights, everybody that looked at what happens on these global scales in things like the WTO and their policies and how much they work within the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF, and how those three entities are all interrelated and don't put people or environment first.
So it seems to me that there is a core group of people that take action this way. But it feels like most of us, and I said us, you know, me included, we're not inclined to do that, but encounter things every day as part of our daily lives that we may need to address. So I'll give you an example of something and, you know, talk me through this. So I just bought a house in Delaware, and what I found about Delaware, which I think is true about everywhere I've ever lived, is, you know, in these cities, you go block by block. One block is beautiful. Another block or series of blocks might be tough areas. And so where I live, south of me is a distressed area, an underserved area. And then north of me is a lovely, lovely area. So I go to the greengrocer in the distressed area for my first time. And I noticed that the parking lot was just full of trash. I noticed there were a lot of unsupervised children running around. And when I got inside the store, the fruit and the vegetables were on crates on the floor. Now, when I shop at the Acme, you know, the beautiful display and, you know, the sprinklers of washing the produce constantly, and the floors were dirty. And I picked up a potato and I turned it over and the backside of it was rotten and there were bugs in it. And I left and my heart was broken because I remember thinking all these people and all these children being underserved here and getting angry and saying, you know, I have a choice. I've got a car. I can go to the north, to the lovely, beautiful, you know, grocery store. But what about all these folks that don't have the options? And what do I do? How do I disrupt what I think is something that is not social justice? I think it's inequity, inequality, and I think it's wrong. How do I deal with that?
I think that when you're faced with situations like that, bringing attention to it and being willing to say something, I think, is the first step. Talking to management. And if that doesn't get anywhere, and often it doesn't, talking to higher up management, utilizing, you know, media to show the issue, getting the word out there, getting the images out there, showing the comparison, having facts behind you. Facts are very important to me, statistics and things that up until recently really weren't arguable.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next step is community organizing. On the local issue, it's all about community organizing and bringing people together and utilizing your dollars. And the hard part about that is you come from a place of privilege in being a car owner to be able to go somewhere else. But like you mentioned, people that don't have that ability, it's the same reason why people buy overpriced food at corner stores that don't even really have produce and are overpackaged and all these things. It has to do with lack of resources and finding a way within the community to make that pressure for the businesses that are basically making profits off of the people in those communities, making the community, holding them to higher standards is a place to start.
I saw in that an opportunity for individual action as well as what you're saying, collective action. For our show, we had five storytellers, each sharing with us a situation where they encountered something. And if you don't mind, I'd love to hear your feedback on a couple of the scenarios that, we had in the show. So, for example, Denise goes into a salon to get her hair cut. And as she's getting her hair cut, she hears someone saying something that she vehemently disagrees with. Now, she's in a precarious situation because somebody's got a pair of scissors cutting her hair. You know, so this situation could have long-term ramifications if she doesn't handle it properly. So what do you suggest when you're out and you encounter a stranger providing a service to you that has a position that is absolutely disruptive to you?
That's a great question. And that, to me, is two-prong. So one is from the woman who's sitting in the chair and hears such things, using her voice to say, hey, that's not okay. But the problem with that is, like you said, she's in a precarious situation herself. If she can't say it at that moment, pulling somebody aside later and saying, hey, that's not okay, and this is why I felt uncomfortable in your salon that you allowed this to happen. As a business owner, we've seen the side of ugly. A couple years ago, we were filming a wedding at a popular museum here in Philadelphia. And while we were waiting to take some photos in front of it with the wedding party, I said, oh, let's just wait for some of those kids. They're leaving, so we'll just wait till they're not in the background. And a groomsman made a comment about not being willing to wait for those tar babies to move. And I was in shock, to say the least. And in my brain are all those things that are going on is I'm a business owner. I can't just start screaming at this person. We still have the whole reception to shoot. What do we do? And I said, what did you just say? And luckily, my African-American husband did not hear it. But he saw my reaction, and he knew something had happened. And his first instinct was to protect me, and he thought somebody said something derogatory to me. And so my first important thing to do was to make sure he was okay and be like, no, don't worry, you just keep going. I will talk to you later. I addressed it with the groom because he was the only one on that whole wedding side who was willing to even acknowledge that it had happened. And he apologized profusely. But again, we had to keep going and we had to be professional. And so we addressed it with the groom and then I addressed it with the venue so that they were aware of what had happened in case something else would have happened.
That reminds me of Steve Clark's story in so much as Steve had a vested interest. He was running for office. And what he did was, this was in the era of cut and paste. So he found an image from the internet that he really hadn't done the research on. And so he put this image on his flyers. And all of a sudden, he's getting responses from people, like winks and nods from people that normally don't talk to him. And so he goes on the internet and finds out that it's a symbol for white supremacy. But he's perplexed, just like you were, because he wants something. He's in the middle of something. He's got a vested interest. And he's, you know, do I just kind of keep my head down and get their votes so that I can get in? Or do I pull it off and risk not getting what I want or, you know, losing my interest. What would you say about that?
To us, if we had known this about this couple or that this would have happened or they had given any indication that they felt this way and had such strong racist views, we wouldn't have taken them mm-hmm. as a business, as a client. We fully believe in people over profits, and we will not accept people that we feel are not a match to the best of our ability. Unfortunately, it's the X factor, right? In a situation like that, I don't want their votes, so to speak. I don't want their money. In the middle of a gig that we're already doing, we have to be professional, so we have to handle it that way. But in today's time, actually, it's so much more dangerous right now. And my husband and I talk about this, and especially after the murders in Portland, because we do believe that it's our place. It's who we are as humans that we need to stand up for each other. And now it's very scary and very dangerous. And with him being almost 6'2", 6'2.5", people perceive African-American men as such a threat. And things escalate so much that we've talked about in certain situations, which one of us stands up and says something. As a male, he wants to come to women's defense as well of support, not, oh, they're a woman, they can't handle themselves, I need to rescue them, but that I need to show support to people that are Muslim. We want to show that support. We want people to realize that somebody has their back.
Right.
And now it means something completely different. But I do believe that that's still what we have to do.
I would agree. And the instance in Portland that you're referring to, of course, is when the gentleman was berating two young women on the subway, one of which was wearing a hijab. And he starts berating them. And two white males, right? Just two. Mm-hmm. And one of them was very, you know, in my opinion, he was just a regular, small kind of guy. And, you know, this incident just erupted and there was loss of life. And, you know, I know from that, listening to that, I was like, oh my God, because I'm just that person that would have been like, you be quiet.
Right. I'm a little mouthy
right.
And actually I'm a lot mouthy. So that is very dangerous.
Right. We're living in an age now where someone would kill you for that. And so I thought that that was really, really quite interesting.
So how do you diffuse? Because the tactics that mm-hmm. you've used are to, you know, enhance the message, give a voice to people who feel they have no other way of communicating. Mm-hmm. At the same time, knowing that there's a point in which if there is too much shouting or if there is too much mm-hmm. aggression, nobody's hearing the message. Mm-hmm. So how do you balance out wanting people to hear another opinion, another view, without de-escalation mm-hmm. that arrives
at nothing?
In a safe
way, sure, yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So de-escalation is a very important tactic and skill to use, and especially as someone like myself who has over the years specialized in blockade methods. My role has been to disrupt traffic, to disrupt people coming in and out of buildings, to disrupt, you know, egresses and whatever people are trying to get to. So people are mad, and it's understandable. People are late for work. They're late for the date. They're late for whatever it is, or they're just tired because they worked all day and they want to get home too. And I understand that. So having a calm voice and having people who are trained and skilled at de-escalation tactics is really important. At the anti-inauguration protests in D.C., my husband and I were there, and we were there, you know, it was before the Women's March. We were there for that as well. But I was a de-escalator at those protests. And my job, so to speak, was to, in those cases, we just put our body in between the pro-Trump supporters and the anti-Trump supporters by simply surrounding what was happening in the situation or just kind of building a little wall. So for example, at one point we were marching down the street and I was with the folks from the Dakota Access Pipeline, the water life, people saving, the different environmental indigenous issues. And there were, you know, four or five pro-Trump people screaming and getting in people's faces. And we just surrounded them very nonchalantly, not threatening, very open-armed, and just kept inviting the marchers just to keep going by us. Don't pay any attention. I don't think it's useful or helpful to scream back and forth at mm-hmm. each other. I don't think that you're going to change somebody's mind. Right. If somebody is bothered to come to an anti-protest of your protest, you're certainly not going to change their mind right then. But if you're blocking traffic and you're trying to explain to people why you're there and you're calm and you're informative, you're going to get more people on your side than screaming at them. I think having literature, having things to give to people, to really explain to people what's going on, but understanding that, yeah, you're going to freaking piss some people off because you're disrupting them who they may agree with you, and they are not the ones with the power to change something. But that's all part of bringing attention to something.
So this idea of using your body and not necessarily your voice at the same time, how could that have played out in Portland? Because I know a lot of people were listening to that news story and thinking, wow, it's not safe for me to speak out in public because I could get killed. But I'm intrigued. How could I have used my body instead of my voice in that situation? Could I have just stood in front of the young woman with my body and just shielded her with my body?
Yeah, that's one of the tactics. So right now, there is some great literature out there on de-escalation tactics and how to do just that. And one of the examples that I had read that really resonated with me in this situation was being able to just sit with the girls and talking with them just in general, like just bringing attention to who they are and just being human with them and letting them kind of know not everybody agrees with this. But then there is this side of like, well, you also have to let these bigots and racists know that that's not acceptable as well. And unfortunately, I'm not even sure how one does that safely. I think you make the best decision you can in the moment. And I think it's important to try to stay obviously as safe as you can to fight another day, right? In that situation, you know, you can't account for that much hate and really that much crazy at the same time. And I'm not even sure standing in front of them would have helped because I feel he probably still would have attacked them as well. And I do know that in general, and that's really all I can speak on that because I'm by no means an expert in all of this. I just have different experiences. But I do believe that it's kind of two-pronged. Lowering your own voice, talking through a calm voice, approaching it from that side for the person who is being the aggressor. Filming it is really important. Making sure you're documenting things that you're seeing. And then also letting the person that you are with that's being targeted, attacked, letting them know that they're not alone and that there is people there that do support them. I think it also depends on where the situation is. You need to talk with the folks that are being attacked. Do they want somebody to intervene? If you weren't on the subway and this were happening, a lot of times people's first initial response is to call the police. Well, that's not very safe for a lot of communities and a lot of people. So really finding out from the person who's being attacked and, you know, verbally, physically, what it is that they want you to do and assessing the situation. I mean, I don't even know on that subway what people could have done different.
Mm-hmm. But there's a difference between an organized event and a spontaneous act of violence and resistance. But if we bring it down from the collective to the family, one of the stories, for example, is this young woman who realizes that her parents are perfectly fine with the assassination of Martin Luther King and Kennedy.
Both Kennedys. Mm-hmm.
But it is still her family. It's still her parents. And so at home, or the amount of discussions around the elections, I don't want to name the candidates or anything, but so during the elections or during the debates about laws and actions in which you have discussions, it's either you don't bring it up, you know, no politics or religion at the table? Or can you bring it up in a way in which there can be some sort of an exchange of ideas, but not an attitude of you get out of here, I don't want to talk to you? So let's bring it to the more personal levels, which is most of the cases in these storytellers, is it's the personal that's difficult.
So I related a lot to hearing that particular story. And I think dealing with your family is the hardest thing that one does when they are not on the same side of you. And finding a support network for that is really important. And a personal story I had is during the Gulf War, my father and I were very split. My father was very, very Republican, very pro-Reagan. You know, and I'm out there in the streets protesting and organizing and getting arrested and all kinds of things. And my father believes in that, yeah, we don't talk about those things. And, you know, yeah, there's all these bad things that happen, but, you know, there's not much you can do about it kind of attitude. And I'm just the opposite. I feel it's my duty to speak up. And we had a huge argument in a restaurant. And we ended up in a piece on USA Today did a story on families that were split over the Gulf War. And we were one of those families. And for years, my father and I barely talked. And he always just thought it was just too radical, just too much. And through a variety of different circumstances, he wasn't at our wedding. People always think it's because my husband's black, and it has nothing to do with that. But he hadn't met Al until several years later. And we were in Florida, and my dad has a place that they live down there part-time, and Al and I were at one of the amusement parks there. And so he came up with his wife, and we had dinner. And it was a really great time. And my father was starting to kind of change and kind of seeing some of the difference in politics. And he lost a lot of money in the financial crisis prior to the Obama administration taking over. And he started to think, wow, you know, there's something going on. There's more. And he started to research and started really looking into things. And I think the moment when he called, as him and his wife were standing in line in Florida in the rain for 3 hours to vote for Obama, the light bulb really went off. And he realized that what I had been fighting for was more than just some passing, you know, rebellious kid thing, that I was fighting for this country and for what I believe in. And he's become a huge advocate of using his voice in his community. And we were in London a couple years back, and he got really sick, and he ended up in a hospital and didn't pay a dime, not one dime. Had CAT scans and, you know, MRIs, all kinds of stuff done. And he went home and started talking to all his, you know, conservative people in the condo complex in Florida and started talking about, like, basically universal health care. And people just thought he was crazy. And he's like, well, no, this was what I experienced. Like, this is possible. And, you know, since then, he doesn't hang out with very many of the people that he ever did. And he's moved out of that condo complex because he just can't stand being around folks that are so narrow-minded. My brother, who was also a strange bird, he was a huge Dead fan and followed the Dead everywhere, but he too was also very pro-Reagan, pro, you know, George Bush Sr., and how much of that comes from, you know, trying to be like your parent or not. But now my brother's like the king of memes on Facebook, and my brother had never protested anything except for when the Cleveland Browns were sold and moved to Baltimore. He took to the streets. Now he's like out there and writing things and participating and, you know, making those phone calls. And so I do believe that people can change. But at the same time, I have a very southern side of my family who isn't so much willing to change. And the huge debate when the Confederate monuments came down in Richmond, which they live outside of, and we really started to kind of see where people truly lie. Yeah, you can be you know, quote unquote, the best anti-racist person you think you are. But those kind of issues really start to bring it out in people. But at the same time, also gave the ability for conversation about it, about why does that bother us? How can you say you love my husband and at the same time believe it's okay to have a Confederate flag waving on the State House? And those conversations don't always happen overnight, and they don't change people overnight. But I stood in the streets with thousands of women and men in all areas of the gender spectrum at the march in D.C. the day after the inauguration. And Michael Moore asked, how many people, is this the first time you've ever attended a march or rally or protest in your life? And so many hands went up. And I just looked on with tears just streaming, that people just all of a sudden realize they've been asleep and they've allowed these things to happen to our country and to the world. And those conversations are starting to happen.
What does the word disruption mean to you?
Disruption to me means standing up for what you believe in, going oftentimes against the grain, maybe against your family, maybe against the government, but taking a stand for what you believe in and being willing to get in the way of the machine that's trying to roll over everybody.
And that can be your family.
And that can be your family.
The authority.
The authorities, your friends, your employers, your clients, and learning to navigate what tactic to use when is the minefield, right? Knowing when do we use our voice, when do we use our bodies, when do we raise our voice, and when do we fight?
Thank you, Kathy Berry Green. And I'm your host, Jamie Jay of First Person Arts, in the studio with Elizabeth Perez Luna of WHYY and Kathy Berry Green. You've been listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. And it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. This month on Common Space, we're hearing stories about pivotal moments where maybe everything changed and storytellers decided to take a stand. You can find that episode by subscribing to Common Space on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening.